Thank you.
Committee on Judiciary come to order. Today is May 22nd, 2013. We're going to first go to a public hearing on Senate Bill 463 and call Senator Shields, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Chip Shields. I represent North and Northeast Portland in the Oregon State Senate. You have heard testimony on Senate Bill 463 before. I believe that Justin Martin from the Confederated Tribes of the Grand Ronde is also here to testify in support, and I think the Oregon Coalition on Domestic and Sexual Violence may have submitted written testimony as well. But really, I'm just here mostly for the edification of the rest of the committee members to let you know that I had some discussions with the chair, and I think we've reached a deal that we would, and correct me if I'm wrong, Mr. Chair, but my understanding is we reached a deal on two amendments, one that would require two legislators rather than one to request the racial impact statement, and that they be of differing parties. And I think that's a reasonable compromise and encourage us to reach across the aisle to work on these issues together. So I'm happy with that. And also we reached an agreement to sunset the bill at January 2018, which I think is a reasonable compromise for us to see how it's going, and we'll continue it on hopefully after 2018 if it's having its desired effects. Just to remind you all about the bill, what I think the real big benefit for the committee members to know about in the bill as it's currently drafted is that Oregon would be the first state, the trailblazer, to require racial impact statements also take into account the ethnicity of the victims. And that is one one really important factor in this that you should know, and I think would be grateful if you all could vote yes on the compromise. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Any questions for Senator Shield?
I have a quick question, yes. Mr. Chair. Senator, thank you for coming in again. I believe it's Dash 5 amendment that requires two legislators to request a racial impact statement, one from each party. But that could be bicameral. It could be a representative and a senator, or both from the senator, both from the, is that correct?
That's correct. They could be both from the same chamber. That was my intention. And so, to be clear, the amendments that we've agreed to are in drafting form stage right now.
Okay.
We don't have any of them.
I couldn't see that.
None of them are ready to move.
Mr. Chair, Senator Shields, actually, we got the amendment back. It's a 5 amendment.
Oh, okay. You got it back today?
Yeah, and it's in the SMS, and it's
great.
In front of them.
Okay. Has my staff seen that? Do you know?
Of course.
Well,
it's on always.
Anyway. Let me take a look at it before you move it.
Representative Shields, one more question.
Yeah, sure. Representative Krieger.
In the staff measure, fourth line, it talks about composition of criminal offender population. This is recipients of human services. What do you mean there?
I think basically that it would primarily deal with child welfare policies as well as criminal justice policies. That's the intent.
Okay, thank you, Senator.
Thanks.
Appreciate coming over. Well, we have that open. We'll call Justin Martin, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Justin Martin, and I'm here today on behalf of the Confederated Tribes of Grand Ronde, where I'm also a tribal member. I'm also proud to be the association manager for the Oregon Tribal Gaming Alliance. We are here today in support of Senate Bill 463. I know you've got a busy calendar, so I won't take a lot of time, and I did submit this testimony in writing a couple weeks ago. So a couple quick points, though. While this bill is not exclusive to tribal populations, we feel it's another important step in the unique government-to-government relationship that Oregon has. We are truly unique, and Senator Shields talked about the unique properties of this bill. We are truly unique here in Oregon, and that's due to a lot of members of this committee and past legislatures in terms of working hard to build positive state and tribal government-to-government relations. Research shows that without law enforcement, prevention, and treatment working in tandem, the system for recovery and prevention fails. We believe that there's a fourth element, and that's one of cultural identity. We feel that this bill would truly help Native populations in looking at that and incorporating that fourth element of cultural identity into that. And for that reason, we are here in support of Senate Bill 463. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony. Any questions, Mr. Martin? Thank you. Doug Harkleroad.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name is Doug Harkelrode. I represent the Oregon Anti-Crime Alliance, and I represent the Oregon District Attorneys Association. I want to make it clear right at the beginning that the Oregon District Attorneys Association is neutral on this bill. Let me say that again. The Oregon District Attorneys Association is neutral on this bill. I don't want to get this confused. My testimony today in opposition to this bill is based on my representation of the Oregon Anti-Crime Alliance, and I've submitted written testimony you can all read, so I'm not going to repeat that, but I want to tell you two things about this bill. This bill is very unusual. It allows the A. N. Gross version, one legislature, and now with the amendment, if that's passed, two legislators to tell the executive branch what to do. Two legislators can tell the executive branch what to do. It's formed in the, it's stated in the bill that it's a request, but then the executive branch, the Criminal Justice Commission, shall do what two legislators request them to do. I don't know of any other bill where the legislature directs the executive branch by two legislators to do something. That seems very unusual, and it seems like there should be
a...
Pardon me?
Might be a good idea. Spread this out, widen it.
I'm going to pass on that. Although I would just briefly comment that the legislature, I believe, needs more independent research capability yourselves. And if you decide that this bill is appropriate to move, you may want to have your own folks at LFO do this rather than the executive branch. That seems more appropriate that you direct your own representatives to do that. Okay, so that's one point. The second point is that victims are not, in this bill, treated equally with criminal offenders. I know they are referenced in here as the composition, but they are not treated equally with criminal offenders. And what I mean by that is that the legislation requires the impact statement to describe the effects of proposed legislation on the racial and ethnic composition of the criminal offender population, the effects on that population, but it does not require that for crime victims. And I submitted a suggestion that the crime victims be equalized so that there is an effect analysis on the crime victims, not just what the composition is of the criminal or the crime victim population. So with that, I'm available for questions.
Any questions for Mr. Parker? Okay, thank you. Okay. Call the public hearing on Senate Bill 463 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 396. Senator Shields, were you going to testify on this bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 396 exempts debtors' health savings accounts from collections of actions and in bankruptcy. It declares emergency effective on passage.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, for the record again, my name is Chip Shields. I represent North and Northeast Portland in the Oregon State Senate District 22. I'm here to testify in support of Senate Bill 396. I will be speaking on behalf of my constituent, Mackenzie Keith, an experienced bankruptcy attorney who represents consumers in Chapter 7 bankruptcy proceedings. He brought forward this legislative concept, and although he came to testify last week on the bill, he couldn't make it today. I brought for you each a printout of his one-pager on the bill. Senate Bill 396 expands Oregon's bankruptcy exemptions to expressly protect funds in a health savings account. and medical savings account from execution by judgment creditors and liquidation by bankruptcy trustees. Individuals set up HSAs and MSAs to set aside money from wages to pay out-of-pocket medical expenses subject to the health insurance plan, to a health insurance plan deductible. MSAs are similar to HSAs but are designed for small employers and the self-employed. Because there is no Oregon exemption that protects funds in an HSA or MSA, this money can be liquidated by a bankruptcy trustee upon the filing of a bankruptcy. Needless to say, this can be devastating to an individual with high out-of-pocket health care who relies on the funds set aside in an HSA or MSA account to pay those expenses. Senate Bill 396 is important for two reasons. One, it helps ensure that responsible individuals with high deductible health plans are able to pay their out-of-pocket medical expenses without having to go into debt. And two, it helps ensure that our local health care providers receive payment for the services they render. I urge you to recommend passage of Senate Bill 396 because it provides needed protection to responsible individuals. I also understand that there is a Dash 5 amendment that is the committee will consider. I wanted to let you know that while I have no idea how that amendment might be received on the Senate side. I have talked to the constituent who came forward with the bill. Talked to the constituent. They considered the policy in both bills and he's willing to risk the challenges that amending the bill might present and is supportive of moving the Dash 5 because he thinks it's that important. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Jennifer Williamson, representative from House District 36. I'm here to speak to the Dash 5 amendments, which I think you all have copies of now. I will tell you the story of the Dash 5 amendments. You may recognize many pieces of this story. The Dash 5 started out as House Bill 3174. You may remember this bill. It would allow for a family going through bankruptcy to use the federal exemptions as opposed to the state exemptions. We had an issue with the relating clause on that bill and decided it was better to just have a new bill drafted, tighten everything up, and it became House Bill 3520. We voted on this bill a couple of weeks ago on the House floor. It moved out on a 50-9 vote. Because of some timing issues in the Senate, it was referred to House Judiciary, to Senate Judiciary, and it's my understanding that that bill will not move. So I am offering today the exact same language that was in the bill that we passed on the House floor into this bill to see if we can move it on the Senate side.
Any questions?
And not necessarily for the representative of the council, perhaps, or anybody who may be knowledgeable. So what I'm wondering about is, let's say an individual is driven to bankruptcy largely due to medical expenses. Mm-hmm. So it's logical to me that the health savings account would then be accessible to the trustee to address the bankruptcy, I would think. I mean, this is how I'm thinking of it. And because it's money that was set aside for health care, and yet health care expenses are what drove them to bankruptcy, mm-hmm. instead to pay down into their bankruptcy account. I guess what I'm asking is, so does the bill provide that, so I don't want them to avoid debt this way, basically. So they're saying, you know, hospital, I owe you money, but you can't get to what I do have because it's in now protected health savings account. But logically, the hospital should probably be able to get to the money in the health savings account. And so does the bill provide an exception along those lines?
Representative Hicks, Mr. Chair. In bankruptcy, the health savings account would just be protected, and it wouldn't matter what the reason for the bankruptcy would be. But the health savings account is an account that you have to think ahead about and put money in and follow a bunch of rules. So if it met those criteria under the main bill, that would be protected no matter what.
Okay.
The reason was, so medical bills wouldn't make a difference. It would be protected.
So I don't know if we're moving this today, but I am kind of curious if anybody out there is knowledgeable on this subject. So I'm kind of curious about that because to me it makes sense that I don't want someone dodging their, you know, it's like the hospital put them in bank, so I don't want them dodging their bill simply by hiding behind this. I'm not, yeah.
Mr. Chair? I'm going to just share my first concerns and why I'm okay with it. They're not identical, but perhaps they can, you know, my concern, and this is a fraction of bankruptcies, I admit, but it just happened to be the ones that I encounter in my law practice, so I think about it all the time. For example, homestead exceptions in the state of Florida, essentially it's a people who very often are going into bankruptcy. Craig Berkman comes to mind, fraud of shareholders, and then we'll build, buy a very, very nice house that's exempt from bankruptcy in the state of Florida, for example. Yeah. There are a variety of those tactics, and so I always am wary of those. I think that this won't be a particular problem, largely because of the contribution limits in an HSA. I don't think there's that much money at issue, and thus I don't think it's a particular vehicle for high net worth individuals evading bankruptcy, at least in any meaningful assets. Now, you have a very specific case, a concern, I admit, that's not quite addressed by that, at least consideration, but it makes me sleep easier.
And Mr. Chair, Representative Hicks, Just to clarify maybe what I said, that the health savings account is set up to pay health savings bills. So, I mean, I guess if you're discharging your medical bills in bankruptcy after the bankruptcy, you wouldn't be able to get to that. But that would be the I think that that, anyway, I'm sorry, I'll have to talk about it later.
Sorry.
I'm trying to think out loud.
Okay, yeah. Sorry to move today, so. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, before you close, I follow up on what Representative Hicks is bringing up. So we know that a lot of bankruptcies happen because people have huge medical bills.
Right.
So as I understand what your question is, so would the hospital or the physician or whatever be able to access that because they are owed money for a medical event?
Yes.
And that's why that person is going bankrupt. So would the physician have access to that account, right?
Yeah.
And I think that's a legitimate question.
Very legitimate question.
Okay. Pete McKittrick.
For the record, Chairman Barker and committee members, my name is Peter McKittrick. I'm an attorney licensed in the state of Oregon. I'm also a Chapter 7 bankruptcy trustee. I've been practicing bankruptcy law for 26 years. I've administered over 10,000 Chapter 7 bankruptcy cases and been involved in the bankruptcy system my entire career. I'm here today to primarily talk about the Dash 5 amendment and why I oppose it as a Chapter 7 bankruptcy trustee, as do many of my colleagues. There are 10 Chapter 7 bankruptcy trustees in the state of Oregon. We're charged with the duty of administering Chapter 7 cases to pay creditors when we're able to collect money from various sources, including some of the debtor's assets, and then disperse that money in accordance with the bankruptcy code. According to the U.S. Trustee's Office, which is an arm of the Department of Justice, in 2011, Oregon trustees distributed over $10 million to various creditor constituencies just from cases where we collected $12,000 or less in assets. Based upon some very quick reviews that three of my colleagues and I did, we distribute approximately $100,000 a year each to priority creditors from our Chapter 7 cases. Those priority creditors include the State of Oregon, Department of Revenue, the Child Support Division, and other taxing authorities. So if you multiply that number by 10 trustees, these are very rough numbers, somewhere approximately $1 million a year is what we pay in priority claims, including to the State of Oregon and to other state and federal constituencies. By adopting the Dash 5 and allowing debtors to claim the federal exemptions, you basically give the debtor a wild card, or in other words, just a free $25,000 in each case that's fully exempt. That's in addition to vehicles, unlimited amounts in their retirement plans, all the other assets that are otherwise exempt under the federal exemptions. To give you an indication of how important this is in terms of the number of assets we're able to administer, in the state of Washington, where the federal exemptions have been applied, approximately 2.7% of their cases, they distribute money to creditors. In other words, almost 98% of their cases, they do not pay anything to creditors. In Oregon, we pay approximately 14% to 16% of our cases, we pay creditors money. Now, the creditors, as I said, some are priority creditors, meaning taxing authorities, child support, other types of priority debts. Others are unsecured creditors, which are medical bills, credit card bills, local vendors, people who have loaned the debtors money. It's a very wide constituency that we serve. The concern that we have with respect to the federal exemptions is that most of the cases that we handle, the debtors have small amounts of debt. It's not unusual for me to see debt of $10,000, $20,000, $30,000 is the total debt that they're trying to discharge. Our concern is that by allowing the debtors to retain such a high amount of assets under the federal exemptions, they could easily be retaining more than the actual debt that they owe. And from a policy perspective, we believe that's flawed. Furthermore, by adopting the federal exemptions, you're basically abdicating the state's interests in its own exemption policies. The bankruptcy code contains the federal exemptions. Those can be amended by Congress at any time. To the extent that those get amended, you lose control over, the citizens of the state lose control over their own exemptions, which we find troubling. The majority of the states do not allow federal exemptions, and we believe that's for good reason. State exemptions vary widely. As Representative Barton pointed out, in Florida you can have an unlimited homestead exemption. Other states have very different homestead exemptions, but it's a matter of state right, and it should not be abrogated to the federal judiciary and to the federal bankruptcy code as to what exemptions apply in the state of Oregon. I'm happy to take your questions. I'm happy to address Representative Hicks' comments as well with the HSA. I'm not here to oppose that portion of the bill. In the many thousands of cases I've handled, I've never liquidated a health savings account of a debtor, partially because typically they don't have that much. If they're struggling financially, they usually don't put a lot of money into those. And there's always been a question about whether they've been exempt, and it's just something that I think we don't typically do. To the extent those become exempt, my opinion is they would be exempt from execution, meaning that hospitals or any other creditors would not be able to get at that money, and they'd obviously be exempt from a bankruptcy trustee. From a policy standpoint, my personal opinion, I think it makes perfect sense because the limitations, I think it's $6,500 per year. It's not a significant amount of money. It's not an opportunity for abuse. I don't have any objection to having those exempt. It will cut off the rights of medical providers or other creditors to get at that money.
Yeah, right. When does a person have access to the federal bankruptcy exemptions? How does a person get to declare federal bankruptcy, I guess?
Well, the bankruptcy code is federal. It's adopted in each of the states, but it's a federal law. And the bankruptcy code provides that states can either set their own exemptions, which Oregon has done, or debtors can have a choice between whatever those state exemptions are and federal exemptions. So at the time the bankruptcy is filed, the debtor, for instance, in Washington would say, I want to rely on the Washington exemptions, or I want to rely on the Oregon on the federal exemptions.
Okay.
So it would be the debtor's choice. In most states, the debtors don't have that choice. The states had said, we want to maintain strict control over our exemptions, and we don't allow the debtors to claim the federal exemptions. And that's been true in Oregon for all of its history, for as far as I know.
Mr. Chair, Mr. McKittrick, actually,
yes.
We changed that in 1981.
Okay, that goes back then past my years.
Please.
So, actually, 21 states allow the debtors to choose either, so it's not the vast majority, I would argue, of states that that have only their state exemptions. And your example about the $12,000 wild card and shielding that,
right.
That those assets. If you had if you used your homestead exemption and you had $12,000 worth of assets in equity in a home, you could shield that, correct? In Oregon,
you could shield the homestead.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, in Oregon, the homestead is $50,000 for a couple or $40,000 for an individual.
Right. So if you have that equity in your home, you can hold on to that.
Correct.
Right? But if you're a renter, you can hold on to $400. In a wild card in Oregon.
Correct, along with all the other assets that you're enabled, for instance, all of your retirement $6,000 worth of vehicles.
Right. But those are the same whether or not you're a homeowner or a renter.
Correct.
You can hold on to the same assets.
Correct.
The difference is if you have equity in a home, you can keep up to $50,000 worth of assets. If you don't have that equity, you have $400.
And I think the policy behind that is that the homestead exemptions tend to keep people in their homes as long as it's not egregious. And the homestead exemption is not just a cash of money that the debtor gets to keep. It stops creditors or trustees from selling their homes if they have, just because they have some equity. But under the homestead exemption rules, if the home is sold, the debtors don't just get to keep $50,000. They have 1 year within which to reinvest that money. Otherwise, they lose the exemption. It's not just a free $50,000 or under the federal exemptions, $12,000. Or it's money intended to provide home ownership. It's not just a free $25,000 like it would be if the debtor doesn't have a home and claims it in cash or miscellaneous vehicles or furs and jewelry or whatever the example might be.
But I guess from a policy perspective, we're protecting home ownership. We're not protecting keeping people in their homes and where they live. Because if you're a renter, you don't have that same protection.
Well, if you're a renter, you don't have the protection whichever exemptions you claim, because you don't own a home.
Unless you hold on to your wild card exemption for rent money.
Well, the homestead exemption in Oregon applies to a lease as well. So it can be used for lease payments or other types of housing. I've allowed a homestead exemption in boats, RVs, leases of apartments for a year or more. All those are eligible for the homestead exemption. In terms of the other only thing that I want to add in terms of numbers is the Department of Revenue gave us some numbers that in for child support only from bankruptcy cases since 2007, the Bankruptcy Code was amended in 2005. The child support program has collected $1.7 million from bankruptcy cases in Chapter 7 and Chapter 13 cases. Under the federal exemptions, that number is going to go down. We can't tell you exactly how much it's going to go down. But approximately 85% of the cases that we currently collect money on, we will not be collecting money on anymore. And as I said earlier, the first priority of that goes to child support, to taxes. And so there is a direct revenue impact of the federal exemptions on the state of Oregon and on the Internal Revenue Service in the United States as well.
Okay. Any further questions? Thank you, Mr. Kicker.
Thank you.
We close the public hearing on Senate Bill 396. Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 98.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 90A authorizes state court administrator to establish reasonable fees for the certification of shorthand reporters. Define certified shorthand reporter as person who has been certified in stenographic reporting or voice writing. Defines voice writing reporting. Deletes the requirement for biennial renewal of certificates and authorizes the state court administrator to issue regular renewals of certificates. Changes certified shorthand reporters advisory committee so that 4 of the 7 members are stenographic or voice writer reporters with 5 years experience. Deletes the speed requirements and declares emergency effective on passage. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Ms. Braun. And there were some amendments that aren't moving forward today, but it's brought to light many issues surrounding the court reporters, how and who there is eligible for certification, how and who have demonstrated competency. I intend to call this subject into a work session during the interim so that we can take a good look at these things and in consultation with the Judicial Department, take a close look at where we should move on these issues in the future.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
You said we would call a work session. You meant a work group, didn't you?
Work group. Thank you. Thank you. Robert Nudlin, Carol Studemund, Doug Friend.
Good afternoon. I'm Robin Nodland. I am, I have many hats on today. I'm a certified court reporter in Oregon and in Washington, and also nationally certified, been reporting since 1980, still reporting on the machine. I'm also president-elect of the Oregon Court Reporters Association, and I'm also, another hat, on the CSR Advisory Committee that this bill deals with also. And I have written testimony, but I won't turn it in. I'll just go through the highlights here. I'm urging you to pass Senate Bill 98 without any amendments. The CSR Advisory Committee occasionally gets together with the Judicial Department staff, and we work on things we're trying to change in the program, such as right now the CSR Advisory Committee in statute says that it should have, it is required to have 4 court reporters, 2 of whom are freelance, 2 that are official, and we have no official reporters anymore. So we are out of compliance with one of those requirements. Another one of the regulations in the program is that we cannot give reciprocity to anybody who has passed a test farther back than 2 years. And so we have people coming to our state court reporters who have been working continuously for years and have been certified at our test is 225 words a minute, which is, I'm talking faster than that right now, but who have been certified at 260 words a minute, and they cannot be, they cannot apply for the CSR without getting a test, without going through the testing procedure and going backwards to a slower test. We also do not have a test vendor. Our test tapes vendor disappeared, and so we cannot give those tests anymore. And right now we've been relying on the national test that is given twice a year in our state. And so it's kind of broken, and that language in the program is broken, and this bill would still keep the CSR in statute, but bring the administration over into rules so that we could fix these things that are broken, and but still retain our program. We have tried, previously we have worked with the Judicial Department on these modifications and brought them through through the sessions, and they haven't made it out of the sessions. And so we keep going back every couple of years and trying to fix this thing. And so Senate Bill 90 would fix that, keep the bill in statute, but let us administer the program more effectively. Thank you.
Good afternoon. I'm Carol Studenman, and I'm the chair of the Oregon Court Reporters Association's Legislative Committee, and I'm one of the owners of LNS Court Reporting and Captioning in Portland. And I understand that one of the issues that's come to your attention is that 24 years ago when we started our CSR program, people were grandfathered into the program, and I just want to clear up some confusion about that today. That's a long time ago. I was pregnant with my daughter, and she graduates from college in 10 days, so that's how long ago we're talking here. Back then, the program was under the Bureau of Labor and Industries, and we were told by them after our program was passed in the 89 session that they would have to grandfather people in. And that was how it was, that these were people that were working and had a profession, and the state was not going to take away their profession. And so that's the way it went. And we went along with that. If you got your CSR, even if you're grandfathered in, you still had to get your continuing education points, and you still had to be accountable to the public. But that was the way it went. And so that's the story for the grandfathering. I urge you to pass Senate Bill 90A without any amendments, and I'm happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Thank you. Please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Doug Friend. I'm a court reporting firm owner in Portland. I am a past president of the Oregon Court Reporters Association and am the immediate past president of the National Court Reporters Association, which represents over 18,000 court reporters and captioners. In April of 2012, in the Magazine for Court Reporters, I wrote an article about certification. I said that certification establishes, among other things, benchmark levels of competency. The Oregon Court Reporters Association continues to seek setting benchmarks for competency through Oregon's CSR program. It is for the good of the profession, yes, but it is also for the benefit of the purchasers of our services and the judicial system. Several states use the Registered Professional Reporter, or RPR, exam as given by NCRA as their certification examination. The RPR examination is verified and validated by an outside professional service. There are states that use the RPR as their certification exam for voice writers as well as stenotypists. The RPR is equally adaptable to both methodologies, and should Oregon decide to use the RPR for its certification test, there would be no problem. Our industry leaders preach that instantaneous real-time translation is the imminent future of all court reporting. SB 90-A, as presented, will allow us to maintain certification for the benefit of the public and the judicial system and allow for the verified and validated testing I spoke about as instantaneous real-time voice-to-text technology continues to evolve. I urge you to pass SB 90-A as presented and unamended. I thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for this panel? Thank you, panel. Close the public hearing on Senate Bill 90A in open work session.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move Senate Bill 90A to the floor with a due pass.
Representative Krieger moves Senate Bill 90A to the floor with a due pass. Is there any discussion? Are there any objections? Hearing none, so ordered.
Yes.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay.
Okay.
Call the roll, please.
Representative Barton.
Aye.
Representative Cameron.
No.
Representative Hicks.
No.
Representative Olson.
Aye.
Representative Tomei.
Aye.
Representative Williamson.
Aye.
Vice Chair Garrett.
Aye.
Vice Chair Krieger.
Aye.
Chair Barker.
Aye. Motion carries. Representative Barton, will you carry for us, please?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Open a work session on Senate Bill 46A.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 46A was the bill we heard on May 15th that shortens the time to bring a lawsuit against a design professional from 10 years to 6 years for large commercial structures. There is no amendment, and it's ready to move. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Is there any discussion on the bill? Are there... we have to move it to 46A.
A work session, do we?
We're in a
session. Mr. Chair, I'd like to move Senate Bill 46A to the floor with a due pass.
Representative Krieger moves Senate Bill 46A to the floor with a due pass. Is there any discussion?
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
So you guys might recall I voiced concerns. I've met with the proponents of the bill. My issue with the bill is not this bill. It was the underlying departure that we let through in 2009. It's really not fair to the current proponents of the bill to kind of leave them hanging out when their peers have a six-year statute. That's just not fair. So that's why, in any event, we've agreed that we're not going to use this to try and then expand it into the residential market, which is really a very separate one. And having said that, I'm prepared to support the bill.
Okay, thank you. Is there any further discussion? Are there any objections? Hearing none, so ordered. Who would like to carry the bill?
I don't like it that much.
I would carry it.
Representative Garrett will be the carrier. Open a work session on Senate Bill 592A.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 592A, we heard on March 15th. This was about the Oregon Uniform Trust Code, and we had an amendment that we moved into the bill at that time from Representative Hicks, and it's the A3 amendment, and that's already in the bill, so we just need to move the bill as amended. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move Senate Bill 592A as amended to the floor with a due pass.
Representative Krieger moves Senate Bill 592A as amended to the floor with a due pass. Is there any discussion? Are there any objections? Hearing none, so ordered. Representative Hicks, would you like to carry that bill?
Okay.
Thank you. And next, we'll open a work session on Senate Bill 610A.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 610A was the bill we heard on May 15th. It was conforms the state laws with the Americans with Disabilities Act. It has an A4 amendment that mirrors the U.S. DOJ regulation that allows public entities like zoos to impose legitimate requirements necessary for the safe operation of its services, programs, or activities. We were waiting for the paperwork on this one, and it's ready. We have no revenue impact and a minimal fiscal impact. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Council, does this what effect would this have if somebody said, "I'm going to take my dog to prison"?
I believe we have somebody in the audience that can address that, but we did have an opinion that prisons are not public accommodations, so that would not affect that.
Well, Mr. Chair, I would note that at Coffee Creek and at McLaren, both, one of the best programs actually is dog training, but a parenthetical point perhaps.
Yes, you can come up, please. Can you answer that?
Good afternoon, Chair Barker, member of the committee. For the record, my name is Elizabeth Kushwa. I'm the Legislative Director for the Bureau of Labor and Industries. This bill addresses assistance animals in places of public accommodation. There is another bill up in the body which has passed out of the House and is in the Senate now, House Bill 2668, which deals with expanding bullies' purview over places of accommodation to those run by public bodies, holding public bodies to the same standard that they hold private commercial entities. That bill has been amended in the Senate to exclude the actual inmates and custodians of OYA because they are not places of public accommodation. They're not free to come and go. However, we did not want to exempt all of DOC because that is open to the public for tours, for visitation. And so those public places will remain public and therefore subject to public accommodation law. I will also note that in terms of disability, the ADA applies everywhere, and that's federal, and that's nothing that any bills that we pass will have anything to do with. So.
Yes, Representative Creek, so you'd have to allow a dog or one of these horses. It says horse on here.
Miniature horse.
Chair
Barker, Representative Krieger, as you heard in the previous testimony, you may or may not have heard, miniature horses are there because in some religions that's a piece that has to be dealt with in terms of the religious protected class piece. So that's why miniature horses are in there. So when you say they have to accept them, I'm not overly familiar with what the federal government does about those things.
And just to clarify, so the if I have a service animal and I go to visit somebody in prison, I could probably take them to the visiting area, but the prisoner doesn't get to take them inside. Is that correct?
Chair Barker, if you have an assistance animal in a public place, yeah, you would have to be allowed to bring it in.
Okay, thank you. Any further discussion? Is there any questions? Okay. I'm sorry, Mary, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Mary Botkin with AFSCME, Council 75, for the record. We are currently working with Legislative Council on amendments that will clarify this. There is a case out of Connecticut that he is using as his guidance on drafting a set of amendments that will resolve the issue of public accommodation for prisons, OIA facilities, local correctional facilities and jails, and the Oregon State Hospital. And I am way out of my league here, but my understanding from my meetings with Mr. Cheek, who I wish was in the room right this minute, is that the Connecticut case clearly says that these facilities are not covered under public accommodation because the public does not go there for services, and the superintendent of these facilities has the ability and the right to deny access to any citizen based on other criteria than disability.
And Mr. Chair, I want to clarify, that amendment is not for this bill. That amendment is for House Bill 2668.
Okay. Right. And I don't want to get crossways with Boley because I'm on their side on this, generally speaking. But I also want to be sure that we make it very clear that inmate visitors are not considered to be the public as it relates to this issue. That's my understanding. And the council can certainly correct me if I am misunderstanding something here.
Mr. Chair, and I spoke to Legislative Counsel Charlie Cheek about this issue, and he agreed with you that the superintendent of the prison has the authority and
let me clarify that I agreed with him.
Yeah, they can preclude someone from coming in even if they have a service animal. They get to be in charge of that area.
Our concern as a union, our concern is that inmates, we don't want inmates or residents of these facilities to have yet another legal avenue to harass staff and the administration. We have lots of processes internally for inmates to resolve their grievances. We don't want to give them access to Boley on top of it. That's just the issue.
Thank you very much. Yeah, it is clear that they get to pick who gets to come into the visiting rooms.
Mr. Chair, for the record, my name is George O'Coolidge here on behalf of Disability Rights Oregon. Just to sort of how we understand it is, you know, there's actually a U.S. Supreme Court case on this. It was Pennsylvania Department of Corrections versus Yeski from 1998. It was a unanimous decision authored by Justice Scalia that considered the ADA does apply to public prisons, but as been said, the language that we added in the Dash 4 amendment, and it's really that starts on line 8, and I'll read, you know, sort of that the place of a public accommodation or of access basically the place of public accommodation may impose legitimate requirements necessary for the safe operation of the place of public accommodation. That language is the federal language, which has been interpreted to say there are places based on these safety requirements where assistance animals are not appropriate. But in terms of that overall building, we do believe the ADA does apply to it. Like I said, it's just the certain circumstances where safety requirements do impose some additional requirements.
Thank you, Representative Tomei.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So maybe, I don't know if this should be directed to you, George. So when somebody has an assistance animal, do they have to show any kind of proof that a physician or a mental health counselor or someone has said that this is an appropriate service animal?
Chair Barker, Representative Tomei, they don't have to show any proof of documentation. You can ask the person what the service animal is trained to assist with, but you can't ask if they have a specific disability or have proof of paperwork or anything. That's an issue that commonly has come up with, like, grocery stores and
right.
stuff. And we actually worked with Jim Gardner from Walmart on the sort of original language of the bill to make sure it was okay with them, and they were fine with the language.
Mr. Chair, I want to just say that inmates don't get dogs, okay? We train dogs for people who need them. They don't get to own them. And, you know, I mean, it's really important that you understand that there are some lines that we don't want crossed, and we don't want inmates to have dogs that could be used against staff.
Can I follow up? Thank you. So I get you, Mary, but I guess I'm still back at the grocery store and at the farmer's markets. So somebody brings in a pit bull to a farmer's market and says, this is my service animal. What can the farmers market, the administrator there, do anything about that? They can ask, you have a service animal, right?
Yeah, Representative Barker, Representative Tomei. They can ask, you know, you can, again, ask sort of what the disability is. You can ask what the service animal is trained for. So you can say, you know, one of the issues for, like, PTSD cases is these dogs are trained to kind of, you know, if people have issues with personal space, kind of the dog gets in the way of them and somebody else. So they can say, this dog, you know, protects me from other people. Some of these dogs, I guess, look around aisles and kind of go behind booths.
They're
and
trained.
Stuff. So they're trained to do that.
Follow up on this.
But there's no
proof that they've been trained to do that. All somebody has to say, this is my animal that's protecting me from concerns if I have PTSD, right?
Yeah. I mean, it's essentially, I mean, the ADA, you know, it's pretty broad here, my understanding.
I'm following up. Some of you know I was born in West Virginia. In West Virginia, there are a lot of people who believe in poisonous snakes, and they find them very comforting. So can somebody bring a poisonous snake into the local farmer's market and say, this is to help me with my PTSD?
So one of the things that Chair Barker, Representative, that the bill does is it limits it to the federal definition. And the federal definition is just dogs and miniature horses, or as other animals, as BOLI defines by rule. So there are some criteria in terms of what certain things animals have to do. You know, I know.
How would my farmer's market administrator know that? What BOLI has said are appropriate things for the animal to do?
I would actually maybe defer that question to Elizabeth. I don't know what kind of public information how they distribute.
Thank you, George. I didn't mean to put you on the spot.
Elizabeth.
Hello again. For the record again, Elizabeth Kushwa with BOLI. Representative Tomei, there are several ways of knowing this, and part of the reason we talked about assistance animals in areas of public accommodation is that the federal guidelines differ between public accommodation and, except for example, things like housing. Housing, there are no limitations for those kinds of things. However, in public accommodation, there are. And this is mirrors the federal language for that. One way that your farmers market would know would be to visit BOLI's website. We have all that information listed online.
Could you email that to me, please?
Chair Barker, absolutely.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, thank you. Yes, Representative Hicks.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I mean, the bill, with George, on page one, down on line 15, assistance animal trainer, sounds like the kind of inmates that, so what do you think about that?
Mr. Chair, again, Mary Botkin for the record. Representative Hicks, a trainer is somebody that the Department of Corrections establishes as a trainer, and there are very strict rules about how you get into the pool to be a trainer, and pretty rigid requirements once you become a trainer. Now, they only train dogs. We don't train snakes or chickens or miniature horses or anybody else, okay, or anything else, okay? So they only train dogs, and the rule is you have to, an inmate has to be, I believe, I'm going to do this from memory, I believe it is 5 years without a disciplinary action against them while they're in this facility. That once they've done the 5 years without a disciplinary record, then they can go into the pool to be selected.
Okay.
Once they're selected, then they move into a special housing unit, and the individuals in that housing unit are then assigned a dog to train. One disciplinary action inside the housing unit removes you from the program, and you are not allowed to return to it. So it's a very rigid sort of requirement to be a trainer, and it's pretty easy to get thrown out of it because it's a very highly sought-after position. But they are in a special housing unit. They're not in the at-large population.
Chair Barker, yes. Representative Hicks, if I can elucidate a little bit. This is, again, for areas of public accommodation. Trainers, for example, would be going into taking a training service animal into a restaurant give them an example of how that is. And this was to deal with those things, is how can an animal know how to behave in certain situations unless they are put in them? So this became an issue with the trainers, the certified trainers, and the animals. And that's what that goes to. That does not speak to the other issues.
But if I may, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
So I'm just talking about the inmates now. So I fairly endorse. But let's focus on the inmates, because it sounds like the case I have not read, but you have, the Supreme Court case, says that certain portions of the prison may be designated as non-public, but the entire sort of facility is considered public, but there was an exception for
the safety considerations,
and yes, considerations. And so somewhere in there, is there a way that an assistance animal trainer, an inmate who's been assigned to this program, would then have a legal recourse through this bill to start suing the Department of Corrections, because the area in which they are operating and training or whatever, residing, is not designated as such due to the safety concerns? I don't know. Is this making sense?
No.
Follow what I'm saying?
No. Chair Barker, Representative Hicks. It does make sense. I was trying to sort of legally walk through how, you know, what avenue a person would, you know, either sue or avoid being sued.
They're training a dog. Now, suddenly, if they wanted to argue it, they could say they're an assistance animal trainer, even though they're an inmate. And they've been deprived, so they claim, of something to which they are entitled under the law. So now they're going to sue Department of Corrections. And Department of Corrections has to fall back on the Supreme Court case to designate whether the area in which the deprived rights, the deprivation of rights, is occurring was set aside for safety purposes or not designated as a place of public accommodation. That would be, I guess, the suit.
And I guess, honestly, I don't know the answer to that. Maybe Elizabeth.
Chair Barker, Representative Hicks, I would be happy to share with you the amended House Bill 2668 so you could take a look at the exemptions for inmates under public accommodation.
So, but if that has to follow the federal ADA, it has to follow, and of course, the Supreme Court is going to be. I don't know. So I don't want there to be a crack appearing in this system, because an inmate will find it. Her concerns are valid. Okay, so well, we can talk at some other point. But this is.
Is this making sense to you? What I'm saying? They're training a dog. Now they're going to say it anyway.
And the taxpayers are.
Framed it nice.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hicks, Mary Botkin. A more practical concern that we have is that an inmate might, I mean, assistance dogs or animals aside, okay? A more practical, real concern that we have is we have facilities with multi-level housing units. If an inmate was to desire placement in a different housing unit for any number of reasons that they may come up with, if they were determined to be disabled in some manner, they could force the institution to move them sort of randomly, and in fact could increase costs for the institutions in transporting inmates from institution to institution based on a complaint that they would be able to file both internally and with the Attorney General's office and with BOLI. What we're trying to do is limit their appeal avenues, not to stop them, but to limit them, and to do it in a consistent way with ADA and that meets BOLI's needs for the public accommodation bill. And that is the amendment that we've all been working on. And so I'm in way over my head on this legally, but I'm doing the best I can to explain to you what I know and what our practical concerns are.
Okay, thank you, panel. Appreciate you coming up and helping.
Well, run it. So I like the underlying policy.
Let me flag it with a no, and then I just want to continue. I do like the underlying policy, okay?
You're worse
but
than I am.
I do want to get these questions answered, because this could cost a lot of money, you know?
Yeah, which is what we don't want.
And we don't want that. We don't have a lot of money, so let me do that.
You want me to roll it over and take a look at you, see?
Got it?
Okay. Do you need the dash fours? Amendment 3 right here.
No, we need to move it in.
Okay, dash fours?
Yeah.
Okay. We're in work session. Commissioner Chair, I'd like to move the dash fours into Senate Bill 610.
Representative Krieger moves the dash fours into Senate Bill 610. Are there any, is there any discussion? Are there any objections to the amendment? Hearing none, so ordered.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move Senate Bill 610 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Krieger moves Senate Bill 610 as amended to the floor with a due pass. Is there any discussion? Call the roll, please.
Representative Barton?
Aye.
Representative Cameron?
Aye.
Representative Hicks?
No.
Representative Olson?
Aye.
Representative Tomei?
I think before I vote, Mr. Chair, I'd just like to make the statement. I just think a lot of people abuse this right, and I'm really concerned about it, and I wish that we, that this legislation could identify how people can claim that they, that this is a service animal. I'll vote yes so that it can pass, but I hope that we look at that in the future and how this is abused.
And thank you, Representative. And one of the problem, or one of the reasons for that, is it's federal law, and so you can't ask somebody about their disability. And they're, you know, so it's like all the HIPAA, that kind of thing. So
yeah.
Is.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Please Representative continue. Williamson?
Aye.
Vice Chair Garrett?
Aye.
Vice Chair Krieger?
Aye.
Chair Barker?
Aye. Motion carries.
Not in a million years.
Well, he was interested in
okay,
the
Representative Williamson will be a carrier.
I'll carry.
We could have the IRS looking. They're doing lots of things nowadays.
Okay. Oh, Lord. Okay. I'm sorry for those of you who came to see Senate Bill 835 today. There are more amendments that we don't have before us yet, and so we will not be able to move that today, and I'm going to roll that over to the 30th, and so we should have something ready to go by then.
Are you here to testify?
Is there anybody here to testify on that today? I think
it was just a work session.
Work session. So, okay. Is there anything further to come before the committee?
No. Thank you.
We're adjourned. Thank you.